This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Changes may be on the way for North Carolina's driver's education curriculum. If a bill filed in the State House of Representatives passes, prospective drivers will learn how to interact with law enforcement officers during a traffic stop. The legislation, known as House Bill 21, has bipartisan support, and proponents say it makes roadside interactions between motorists and officers clearer and safer. But not everyone is on board with the bill. Chris Thomas has this.
It's night, and in your rearview mirror, flashing blue lights.
Don't make any sudden moves. Don't reach under the seat. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. Turn on the dome light in your car so the officer can see into your car.
Eddie Caldwell is Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the North Carolina Sheriff's Association, which represents all 100 sheriff's departments in North Carolina and lobbies the General Assembly on their behalf.
Don't reach into the glove compartment. Many of those things could be very innocuous, very non-threatening to the driver who's reaching under the seat to get their purse, to get their driver's license, or reaching in the glove compartment to get their driver's license. But to the officer who's approaching the vehicle, they're concerned that they may be reaching for a gun or other weapon.
Caldwell says these are common sense procedures for civilians interacting with police officers, though they aren't always approached that way.
I certainly don't think it's second nature for most folks, because most folks don't get stopped by law enforcement very frequently. And when they do, they kind of panic and think, oh my goodness, am I going to get a ticket? Or, you know, are they looking for somebody else and they've stopped my car? And so I don't think it's second nature for hardly any of the drivers.
He touts it as a way to improve officer-motorist interactions, making roadside expectations required reading for license holders. The Sheriff's Association is one of the three stakeholders listed in the bill. Should HB 21 become law, the Sheriff's Association, State Highway Patrol, and the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police will draft procedures in conjunction with the Division of Motor Vehicles. The bill is short on details regarding the proposed curriculum, and Caldwell says that's how it should be.
They recognize that it's a policy issue and it's a public concern, and what the bill does is it directs the experts to all work together to design the end product, and that's the way government ought to work.
The bill was referred to the North Carolina House's K-12 Education Committee in late February, and hasn't budged since. But it does enjoy support across party and geographic lines. Several representatives from predominantly rural districts are listed as the bill's co-sponsors, including Democrat Shelley Willingham. He represents House District 23 in Edgecombe and Martin counties. He wants to show support for representatives in more populated districts, even though he doesn't believe it's a major issue in rural eastern North Carolina.
And hopefully when we have bills that mainly affect rural areas, that we'll get some of those urban folks to support our bills too.
Black motorists are disproportionately pulled over and arrested by sheriff's agencies in both Edgecombe and Martin counties, according to figures from the North Carolina Department of Justice. That's also the case for the Rocky Mountain Tarboro Police Departments, where 77.1% and 67.9% of traffic stops, respectively, involved black motorists in 2016. Willingham still says his constituents have solid law enforcement relations.
I think the police departments and all the, you know, the two cities and all the towns have real good relationships with the community, and so we really haven't had any problems there.
But HB 21 skeptics like Mike Minot, who represents the North Carolina chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, wonder if there are underlying motives. In its present form, only law enforcement agencies would create the traffic stop curriculum. Civilian and civil rights organizations like the ACLU would be left out. He worries the bill, if enacted, will shift an unfair burden of responsibility onto especially vulnerable members of the population.
Police have a certain vested interest in these interactions, but we need to remember that the rest of us have rights as well, and that the Constitution protects those rights for everyone. And so we think it would be really important if organizations that work on civil rights issues, that provide legal defense to individuals, are also consulted and allowed to weigh in on this bill and the educational pieces attached to it.
Minot believes the bill shows promise, especially for young people who may be frightened during traffic stops.
I think young people also have a right to know their rights when dealing with law enforcement. And young people more than a lot of others might not know how to assert those rights. And just because you're young, it doesn't mean you're not protected by the Constitution.
He hopes the state will remind new drivers of their rights as well as their responsibilities. Last year, State Highway Patrol reported 46,727 traffic stops with motorists under the age of 20.
There's certainly nothing wrong with trying to educate the public about the expectations that law enforcement have during police interactions, but I think it is equally, if not more important, that we make sure the public is also educated about their rights to remain silent, to not consent to searches, to ask simple questions like, am I free to go, if you are being questioned by a law enforcement officer.
But some supporters of House Bill 21 say that isn't the point of the legislation. And while North Carolina Sheriff's Association Representative Caldwell says there will be time to hear from all kinds of stakeholders, this bill isn't about civil liberties.
This is not a miniature legal course in constitutional rights and other rights under the statute. This is a bill about safety and about uniform things that people should do in order to communicate the right intentions to a law enforcement officer who's pulling them over.
He says if motorist rights are added to the driver's education curriculum, it can come through another bill.
If they want somebody to teach a class on the legal rights of a motorist, that's a different bill and a different issue. That's not what this bill is about at all. This bill is about public safety, motorist safety, and officer safety, not about constitutional rights.
The bill still is in its earliest stages, Representative Shelley Willingham says, and should it come up to a committee's agenda, he believes more organizations will come to the discussion table.
When the bill goes in the committee, we try to get the input from stakeholders, and I'm certain that the bill will be amended or changed in some way, because what you start out with, in many cases, you know, it's either less or more when it comes out on the other end.
For information on your rights, traffic stop procedures, and more, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Chris Thomas.
You're listening to the Down East Journal on PRE, Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh with George Olson. Thank you so much to everybody who's made a pledge so far during our Spring 2017 fund drive at your public radio station. If you have not made your pledge, now is the time to pick up the phone and dial 1-800-222-9832. You can also make a secure online pledge at publicradioeast.org. During this fund drive, your participation is key.
About 56% of the funds we use to get programs like the Down East Journal on the air come from individual listener contributions. And you don't have to be a math major to figure out how important your pledge is to this radio station when you hear those figures. Yes, we also get some money from local business underwriters, but I doubt they'd have a whole lot of interest in supporting the station if the community wasn't already backing it. And yes, we still get some funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. One of the things they ask us when we're filling out forms for that money is tell us about your community support. So listener contributions are the first and foremost link in the financial chain here at Public Radio East. Really, what you hear on this station starts and ends with you. Your pledge makes all the difference in the world, and we're asking you to pledge in any amount to help keep local journalism efforts like the Down East Journal alive and well in eastern North Carolina. You can call us now at 1-800-222-9832. Again, it's 1-800-222-9832, or pledge online at publicradioeast.org.
And as we're talking about funding allocations, you may have seen the headlines recently. There's a lot of conversation around Washington right now regarding a total cut of funding for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Public Radio East has been working for years to become financially self-sufficient. We view the potential loss of all federal funding as another critical reason for us to get support from everyone who listens to Public Radio East. Your pledge is vital to the success of Public Radio East. We cannot continue to operate and continue to present programs like the Down East Journal without member support. Call 1-800-222-9832. Make a renewal pledge today or become a new member.
And the size of your pledge, again, is entirely up to you. I do want to remind you about the new member challenge we have on the books right now. If we can get 250 new members, folks who've never pledged to this station between now and the end of this drive next Friday, we have a group of generous donors who've said they'll contribute an additional $10,000 to the Public Radio East programming budget. So we've made good progress on that so far, but still room for you. So make that first-time pledge. Have double the impacts again, because we might get this new member challenge. Again, might is the operative word. It's not a for sure thing. We have to get 250 new members to be assured of receiving this $10,000. So if you haven't made a pledge to this station as of yet and like to have your pledge have more of an impact, make that first-time new member pledge now at 1-800-222-9832. Again, it's 1-800-222-9832.
So how do you like your oysters? A little hot sauce, some butter, maybe served on a cracker? They're a delicacy along the North Carolina coast, and can you believe it? They're good for you too, with copious amounts of vitamins and minerals. And more good news, access to fresh local oysters is improving thanks to restoration efforts by local scientists, the State Division of Marine Fisheries, conservation groups, and local fishermen. But what if you could grow your own oysters in your backyard and harvest them whenever you'd like? That's the idea behind the Underdock Oyster Culture Program, or UDOC. Terry Barrett is the aquaculture coordinator with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries.
We have to have a dock that you own. So it really is limited to waterfront property owners. So the dock has to be an authorized legal dock permitted. And then under that dock is where you can have 90 square feet of cages for the oysters.
UDOC participants place oyster cultivation containers, similar to crab pots, under their dock or pier. Over time, oyster spat begin to attach to the 2-foot by 3-foot cages, and in about 2 or 3 years, they're fully grown and ready to be harvested. Sounds easy, right? Well, Barrett says the process is a little more involved.
You do have to watch them and clean them regularly and turn them, check your cages. And it's a little more involved, I think, than people expect.
Currently, there are only 17 people in North Carolina who participate in the UDOC program, administered by the Division of Marine Fisheries in conjunction with North Carolina Sea Grant. When it started back in 2004, about 40 people were involved. Barrow thinks interest has waned due to the difficulty in growing oysters and the regulations that are a part of the process. But those up for the challenge reap the rewards.
Once you have a UDOC permit, you can take the oysters pretty much any time of the year, and you can take them undersized.
That means fresh, local oysters anytime, not just in months that end with R.
But what comes with that is the responsibility to know about the organism and about water temperatures and rainfall and bacteria in the water and shellfish closures.
All of these factors affect oysters and being able to determine if they're safe to eat. Oysters feed by filtering up to 50 gallons of water per day, which is great for improving water quality, but makes them susceptible to a bacteria which collects in their tissue, known as Vibrio. Dr. Brett Fralick is a research assistant professor at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City.
We're looking for specifically at two bacteria. Both of them are Vibrio. One of them can cause you to have intestinal discomfort when you eat raw oysters, and the other one can be a little more severe, leading to some severe diseases.
Vibrio vulnificus and Vibrio parahemolyticus thrive in warm environments, so that's why there's a greater risk of getting sick from consuming raw oysters during warm months. Dr. Fralick is involved in an ongoing study which monitors bacteria in local oysters.
But we've really only been looking at wild oysters. And we realize that farmed and gardened oysters are a big part of what we do here in the state as well.
By farmed, Dr. Fralick is referring to oysters grown through large-scale aquaculture practices. And by gardened, he means the UDOC program.
So we've decided, and we were given some money by North Carolina Sea Grant, to take a look at what's going on in our farmed oysters, including those in some people's backyards or backwater areas.
Cultivating your own oysters is a relatively new idea. To date, there hasn't been any research done in North Carolina to compare how garden oysters differ from wild ones.
Gardened oysters are a little different. They're grown differently, they're shaded from the light, they have different boat traffic that gets over them, so they're really something completely different.
To conduct his study, Dr. Fralick purchases several oysters from participants with the UDOC program. The samples are taken to the lab, shucked, and pulverized into a liquid.
From there, we grow the bacteria up, and we examine what's in there. We also save some of the DNA that's in there, and we do what we call molecular testing, in which we are looking specifically for bacterial DNA.
The results will be posted online, and Dr. Fralick says participants will be able to access the data to make sure their oysters are safe to consume.
Contrary to popular belief, hot sauce or lemon doesn't kill Vibrio bacteria. The only way to eliminate any potential health risk is to fully cook oysters. Growing your own oysters is an appealing idea, but before you start making plans for an oyster roast, you have to get a permit. There's a 20-question test you must submit to the State Division of Marine Fisheries, and Aquaculture Coordinator Terry Barrett says your dock must be located in waters approved for harvest of shellfish.
The first thing they do is email me, and I will send them the test. And they do the test and submit it to me. Once they've passed the test, then they can submit an application. And we'll go from there. I'll go and look at it and make sure that it's a legal dock, that it's not impairing anybody's navigation.
Signs are also posted to let people know that the oysters are located on private property. Cages can be purchased from the North Carolina Shellfish Growers Association or Sea Grant. Add some spat and you're ready to start growing your own oysters.
Oysters are good for the environment. Oysters are good on the plate as well. And this is a great way for people to essentially improve both things right here at home.
To learn more about how to get started with the state's Underdock Oyster Culture Program, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
You are listening to the Downeast Journal on PRE, Public Radio East. Good afternoon. I'm George Olson, your host for the Downeast Journal. Jared Brumbaugh is here as well. We're in the midst of our spring fundraising campaign, raising necessary funds to make sure that we can continue local journalism efforts like the Downeast Journal here in eastern North Carolina, also to continue presenting programs from NPR and the BBC. If you come to Public Radio East to know, to find out what's happening in the world around you, to get understanding, your pledge is what makes it happen. So we want to thank everyone who's already made their pledge to Public Radio East during our spring fundraising campaign. But if we haven't heard from you as of yet, now is always the best time to make your pledge to the station. You can reach us today at 1-800-222-9832. Again, it's 1-800-222-9832. You can also pledge online at publicradioeast.org.
With programs such as All Things Considered and Morning Edition, BBC News, you know you're going to get that international and national perspective. But here on the Downeast Journal, you're going to hear stories of local interest, stories about the community in which you live. You're going to hear about the shrimp trawling proposal. We're going to continue to cover that on Downeast Journal, keeping you informed. Also, we heard last week about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that running through eastern North Carolina. These are stories that you need to know about to stay informed, and we will continue to present those each and every week on the Downeast Journal. It's all made possible by your pledge of support. The number to call, 1-800-222-9832. If it's been a while since you've made your pledge, you can renew your membership today. Also, become a new member if you've never made a pledge before. Go to publicradioeast.org, make that pledge, or call 1-800-222-9832.
We're really emphasizing the new members during this fund drive at Public Radio East. We have a new member challenge. We've got a group of generous donors who have pooled their resources together and basically put $10,000 on the table, and we're going to push that into the Public Radio East programming budget if and only if we can get 250 new members making pledges to the station between now and the end of the fund drive, which is scheduled for next Friday. We've made good progress on that, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And when I say new member, I'm talking about someone who's never pledged to the station, stepping up and making a pledge in an amount that's comfortable to you. If it's $25, that makes you a new member at Public Radio East. If you make that $100 pledge, you are also a new member at Public Radio East. And if you make that $100 pledge, don't forget you pick up the Public Radio East member card, and that affords you 2-for-1 dining at some great restaurants here in eastern North Carolina, 2-for-1 green fees, as well as some of the better golf courses in the area as well, too. So kind of a great way to experience some of the finer things of eastern North Carolina while at the same time supporting your public radio station. Make that $100 member card pledge now. You can do so at 1-800-222-9832. You can also pledge online at publicradioeast.org.
Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the upcoming performance by the New York Theater Ballet, the premier chamber ballet company in the U.S., This March 30th performance takes place at Cahen Auditorium on the Tarboro campus of Edgecombe Community College. Featured during the 7:30 p.m. performance, The Sleeping Beauty, and a mixed program of contemporary dance works by well-known choreographers. Today on the Downeast Journal, Mac McKee speaks with board member of the Furman Matthewson Trust, Anderson Farrell, about this free performance.
Anderson, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Well, I'm so happy to be here, and thank you for having me.
It's the fifth straight year now that the Furman Matthewson Trust and the New York Theater Ballet have put Eastern North Carolina in the spotlight. How has the series of performances grown since the beginning?
Well, I think it's grown in this respect, and that is that we have really developed an audience over 5 years for dance. In the beginning, we tried to present things that the general audience would appreciate. And as the time has worn on, our audiences have gotten much more sophisticated about what they're expecting, and we can go a little bit sort of outside the box and edgier, if you will.
The New York Theater Ballet will be showcasing Sleeping Beauty, as well as Legends and Visionaries. That's a contemporary performance of modern dance. How does that mix between traditional and contemporary seem to go over? Can you give us a preview of what audience members can expect?
It goes over very well. As I say, we have a very wide range of age groups and demographic there. And so the people who are coming expecting the typical tutus and tiara sort of ballet will have that. But what's really interesting is the contemporary work in the first act. We have a new work by called Double Andante by Pam Tanowitz, set to Beethoven music. And the interesting thing about that is it's played live on piano and played twice through at different tempi. So that is what I mean when I talk about the edginess. Additionally, we have a new work by Gemma Bond, who is a dancer with American Ballet Theater, an English woman, and then a piece, a sort of classical contemporary piece by Anthony Tudor, Judgment in Paris, set to music by Kurt Weill. So there is something for everybody.
Then Judgment of Paris, I guess, is set to part of the Greek myth?
It is the Greek myth, but it's moved to France. And it's about a boulevardier, an older man, very elegant, who becomes entrapped by three, shall we say, sort of down-and-out ladies of the evening. And it does not turn out well for him, as you might imagine.
How many dancers are with the New York Theater Ballet? And can you describe what the backdrops and stage designs look like?
There are 19 dancers, full-time dancers in the ballet company, including the director herself, Diana Beyer. The contemporary part of the program is really on what we call a black box sort of stage, no sets, but lighting. And the costumes for those works are, as you might imagine, more modern and in some instances almost modern dress. The Sleeping Beauty is everything you would expect from a fairy tale. The set is a painted drop and individual pieces, but the entire ballet takes place at the base of an enormous oak tree and with 6-foot mushrooms growing around it and Princess Aurora, Sleeping Beauty. Bed that she sleeps for 100 years is a very stylized oak leaf. So it's fairy tale land for that one.
In addition to the Thursday evening performance, the New York Theater Ballet is going to have a special performance for elementary school students.
Yes, the New York Theater Ballet is known for its programming for young audiences, and they'll be re-performing Sleeping Beauty that morning for over 1,100 second and third graders. This will be the fifth year in a row we've done that, and they see it absolutely for free. And at this point, we have exposed over 6,000 second and third graders from Edgecombe County to the art of dance and live theater.
Now, the New York Theater Ballet performances coming up on March the 30th, which is Thursday evening, I believe, at 7:30, correct?
That's right, 7:30.
And it's free, but tickets are required to reserve your seat. Anderson, do you still have tickets available, and how many people does Caheen Auditorium hold?
Caheen holds 1,100, and we still have tickets available, but they do go quickly the closer we get to the 30th. But at this point, we still have them. It is free, but you do need a reserved seat.
For more on the performance, you can also check out the ENC events calendar here at publicradioeast.org. Anderson, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Down East Journal on PRE Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh here with George Olson. The number to call to make your pledge, 1-800-222-9832. And of course, if you happen to be next to a computer, you can also log on to our website, publicradioeast.org, and make your financial contribution there as well.
You can reach us again at 1-800-222-9832. In the midst of the spring fund drive, fund drives are just very bottom line business. We are a business, just like any of the brick and mortar stores that you walk through on a daily basis. They have expenses they have to pay. We have expenses that we have to pay. The list of things that we do to make sure you have access to your favorite programs is lengthy. We pay around $225,000 a year for national programming, $40,000 plus a year for electricity costs. Every so often something breaks, you got to fix it. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Bottom line, what you're concerned about is what do I got to do to make sure I can hear the Downeast Journal, to hear Here and Now, to hear Car Talk, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And what you do is quite simple, whatever you can afford to do. If a $25 pledge is where you're comfortable, that makes you a member in good standing. You make that $100 member card pledge, again, a member in good standing. Where are you comfortable? Make the pledge now. Help support the programs you love at 1-800-222-9832.
The Downeast Journal, it's a 30-minute program each Friday and Saturday, but it's literally hours and hours of work that go into producing the show each and every week. And if you rely on the information that you receive here at Public Radio East and on the Downeast Journal, we're saying that you should help support it. 1-800-222-9832 is the number to call. Become a new member. You can also renew your membership. Now is the perfect time to make your pledge.